This is the Women's Protection and Empowerment Podcast, where we give space to talking about women and girls in humanitarian settings. At International Rescue Committee, we deliver innovative programs focused on preventing and responding to violence against women and girls. We are in pursuit of a world where women and girls live free from violence as valued and respected members of their community. This movement is about equitable access to opportunities.
Empowering women and girls means a lot for development of the next generation, and it's important for the development of a country.
It's about catalysts for change.
Women and girls are not just the faces of poverty. They're also the key to overcoming.
It's about voice and respect.
The path to victory is still long, and I'm not ready to give up. This has become to me more than a work, but a passion to see women and the girls regaining what has been for long denied to them.
From IRC, this is the WPE Podcast. I'm Christy Crabtree. Earlier this month, for International Women's Day, the IRC released a new policy report called Why Wait? How the Humanitarian System Can Better Fund Women's Rights and Women-Led Organizations. With contributions from development initiatives and in collaboration with over 10 women-led and women's rights organizations, this new report is part of a wider series dating back to 2019 that aims to track how the humanitarian system is funding interventions to address gender-based violence. Importantly, this also includes looking at funding to women-led and women's rights organizations working to end GBV in conflict and crises contexts. These organizations are integral to GBV prevention and response work, and yet they're under-resourced and underrepresented in the humanitarian system. To better understand this issue, the report does a deep dive into three contexts: Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Ukraine, into one funding mechanism, the UN OCHA Country-Based Pooled Fund. Although this fund reached its localization target in 2021 by channeling 25% of its funds directly to national and subnational organizations, only 3.5% of the overall fund went to women-led and women's rights organizations, suggesting that systemic and persistent barriers remain. To talk more in depth about this report and this topic, we're joined by three guests: Daria Chekalova, Deputy Head at NGO Girls in Ukraine.
Hi, thank you for the invitation.
Karina Kichet, Humanitarian Analyst at Development Initiatives.
Hi, good to be here.
And Brianna Guadorzi, Policy Consultant at the IRC, who led in the development of this report.
Hi, Christy. It's a pleasure to be here.
This report is part of a series that started in 2019. Can you tell us a bit more about that and how this report fits within the overall series?
Sure, Christy, thanks. And it's a pleasure to be on the podcast again, because I know I was on the podcast last time after we released the report, Why Not Local? So yes, this is a series, and we like to call it the question series because every single report does start with a question where we like to pick the reader's interest around the topic. So I'll just super briefly give some context to that series and then explain how this one fits within that. So this series started back in 2019 with a report called Where is the Money? And that report was quite groundbreaking because it quantified that 0.12% of overall humanitarian funding was going to gender-based violence globally. And so that really set the scene for showing just how deprioritized addressing gender-based violence is. And then in 2020, of course, the pandemic happened, and we released the report called What Happened, which looked at how the humanitarian system was responding to that shadow pandemic of gender-based violence during the pandemic. And then in 2021, last time I was on the podcast, we talked about the report Why Not Local, which evidenced that women-led and women's rights organizations are underrepresented, under-resourced in the humanitarian system, and that they're really stuck in a vicious cycle of underfunding. And that report wasn't necessarily groundbreaking in so far as there were a number of feminist activists and WROs and WLOs that had been saying that for a while. So IRC was just kind of adding its voice to that important topic. And so the other reason why this is a series is because we always pick up where we leave off with research questions. And so with this report called Why Wait, we very much picked up where we left off last time of thinking about underfunding. So this time around, we wanted to dive a bit deeper into the funding picture, and we decided to dive into one funding mechanism in particular, the OCHA country-based pooled funds, which you mentioned. And we chose that just for a couple reasons. One, because it's challenging to look at all humanitarian funding at once. I'm sure Karina can speak very well to that. And then also pooled funding in WAIS is supposed to be designed to get funding to national and subnational organizations more quickly. And in fact, the country-based pooled fund has localization as one of its key pillars. And so just to say that how this fits in the series is that, you know, in this report, we found that based on the lived experiences of WROs and WLOs, and Daria will speak later to this, organizations are facing a number of barriers in accessing funding, and that beyond the funding, there's a serious crisis of thinking about how WROs and WLOs are not allowed to take up leadership roles in humanitarian spaces. I'll stop there. I'm sure we're going to dive into the report a bit more.
Thanks for that overview. I think it's really helpful to know how it fits into the series, and then also just to get an overview of some of the things that are covered in the report. One thing that spoke to me was that the report says women-led and women rights organizations face a double disadvantage, both as organizations that are competing for funding within or with international organizations and other national organizations, but also as organizations focusing on or led by women within larger patriarchal systems. I'm wondering, Daria, in your context, if you could speak a little bit more about this.
So unfortunately, it is the truth of what's going on practically in Ukraine. So we as humanitarian organizations are typically faced with two sets of requirements and very high expectations on both of them. On the one hand, we are expected to participate in coordination and attend multiple cluster meetings, working group meetings, develop and implement a range of policies, undergo constant training, submit many reports every month to various partners and stakeholders, and accomplish many organizational tasks. And of course, we welcome these internationally recognized best practices and training opportunities. They are really important, and they mean that all this additional attention now focused on the Ukrainian humanitarian sector, it's really good for us and we're eager to participate. But, and now I come to my, on the other hand, we also need, among all this, to do our core job, implementing our mandated activities, delivering assistance to those in need, to the people we've committed to support. And that's all, these double pressure and double requirements that we face is also happening in a society that becomes more traditional, that returns to patriarchal norms because of the inevitable regress, societal regress that we see during any war, actually, and this is no exclusion. So it is especially difficult for women rights organizations and women-led organizations because the momentum is all about, you know, men being heroes. And why I completely agree, and the Ukrainian army actually, for example, does a lot to promote human rights overall and does fantastic things in Ukraine, we feel that women's impact and efforts that we are doing as humanitarian workers are being overlooked. And the old stereotypes of women who are only able to keep homes warm and care for children in the safety of their houses are going as strong as they ever were. So yes, that is how the situation looks in practice for us as women, but also for us as female humanitarian workers.
I really appreciate you sharing that. I think it's easy for what we believe to be one narrative to kind of speak to everybody as the narrative. And so I think you talking about both sides of this is a really important part of this report to talk about that in the context of Ukraine. And I think it probably speaks to other settings as well, not just Ukraine, that this is kind of a trend that we see in crises.
As you said, Christy, this unfortunately happens in other contexts. And, you know, when you were talking, Daria, Simone de Beauvoir, the French feminist, popped into my mind. And I think she was the one who said that women's rights are never guaranteed and that anytime there's a political or economic crisis, those rights will be the first to go. And of course, that has an impact on women-led and women's rights organizations as well.
I would just like to completely agree. That is 100% truth.
I think another part that's interesting about this series is all the quantitative kind of backup to what you're saying as well. I know development initiatives as an organization, does a lot of tracking of humanitarian funding. And there's a quantitative section of the report called Where is the Money? Love it, very direct. So where is the money? What does the quantitative analysis tell us across these contexts?
So here at Development Initiatives, we are an international development organization. We focus on the role of data and the power of data to improve the lives of people, looking into poverty, inequality, humanitarian crises. And I work as an analyst here in the team looking at humanitarian assistance and tracking humanitarian financing. And really our kind of tracking work is really focused on trying to figure out where assistance is going and trying to figure out if all of the commitments of the international community, of the donor community, are being met. And so for us, it was really important to continue this work and to contribute to this report and really look specifically into where is the money, where is the funding, in this case, looking at pooled funding, so specifically country-based pooled funds as a pooled funding mechanism, and looking into this question of is direct pool funding being channeled to or reaching WROs and WLOs, women's rights organizations and women-led organizations in the three-country context in Afghanistan, DRC, and also Ukraine. So looking into this, as always, is not a straightforward question because, for example, thinking about GBV funding or quantifying GBV projects under the country-based pooled funds is not something that is easily tracked with the data. So we had to come up with a methodology to kind of tag or see this project. Also funding specifically to women's rights and women's led organizations is also not specifically tracked or tagged in the data sets that we work with, in the financial data sets that we work with. So really thinking about ways or proxies to use. So in this section, we look at funding to a kind of local and national non-governmental organizations in the three contexts as a proxy, and specifically GBV funding to this context. In terms of where this analysis shows is really kind of thinking about over the time frame of the analysis from 2017 to 2022, thinking about kind of GBV allocations under the country-based pool funds and whether they were meeting the localization targets, and kind of comparing it against this kind of 25% benchmark or target of which comes from the grand bargain reforms of humanitarian funding being channeled to local and national responders as directly as possible, which I think is an important note of at least 25%. And what we found is that in two of the contexts that we looked at, so in Afghanistan and DRC, the average GBV allocations were not meeting this 25% localization target. So this was 24% in Afghanistan and 17% in DRC. In Ukraine, Daria, this average was not available because for Ukraine, we could only identify, I think, one GBV project in 2022 and then some further kind of passed on or sub-granted funding also in 2022. So we weren't able to calculate an average for Ukraine. But really in terms of where the money is going, it's really going to international organizations or international responders, at least kind of directly or as a first level. So really going to mostly to UN agencies and then to NGOs. And then a very limited, a very small proportion of this funding is also being passed on or subgranted to some national local NGOs, which some of them might self-identify as or identify as a women's-led and women's rights organization. So really it's quite not a great picture in terms of the funding that is reaching these organizations and also in terms of direct funding that is reaching organizations, which is very, 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 very limited funding.
What do you hope sees this section of the report in particular on the money? Is there like a type of role or an organization that you hope would look at this and interpret this in a way that you think would create real change?
Yeah, I can come in a bit. I think in terms of the recommendations in the report, the specific recommendations on funding for WROs and WLOs, and really kind of focusing on the call to action for UN agencies and donors and NGOs to interrogate their funding criteria, to identify barriers to funding women-led and women's rights organizations, to modify their policies, to better meet these organizations. And in terms of really kind of focusing on meeting these localization commitments that were made under the Grand Bargain back in 2016 and were kind of updated in 2020, 2021. So really kind of also meeting the localization commitments by cluster, because while we can see, and you mentioned this, Christy, in the introduction in the report, that the country-based pool funds are meeting a localization target overall globally, we can see that for the GBV subsector or subcluster, this is not the case. So really ensuring that as a minimum 25% of GBV allocations through the country-based pool funds also go to WROs and WLOs directly or as directly as possible.
You hit the nail on the head, Karina, with who we want to see this and kind of the changes we want to make. And I would just really encourage listeners to go and check out the quantitative data that Karina has spoken about, because there's so much there beyond what we can talk about today. And, you know, Karina gave the averages across from 2017 to 2022. What's interesting, too, if we had more time to discuss it, is that there's been fluctuations across those years. And so we've seen really interesting improvements in the GBV allocations in the DRC in particular. And in the qualitative data in the report from the interviews with WLOs and WROs and with humanitarian stakeholders really complements the quantitative data. And for example, in DRC, you see that the country-based pooled fund advisory board had made a number of changes in the last couple of years, which have quite possibly resulted in that improvement in allocations in the DRC. And so the, you know, the qualitative and the quantitative data are really complementary and tell quite a powerful story of ways also that funding to GBV can be improved. And then the last thing I really just want to emphasize to listeners is that, and Karina mentioned this, we can only track the funding to GBV allocations in pooled funds so far. We can only get to the level of national and subnational organizations. And so within that, we can't even say how many or what percentage of those organizations were women-led and women's rights organizations. So we've also been calling for a number of years, we've been calling OCHA to improve their tracking system. And I think that's in the pipeline very soon for them to do, for organizations to be tagged, whether they're WROs and WLOs. So, you know, that's not an easy exercise, but in terms of tracking, there is certainly a value to doing that. We can better answer these questions as we go along, and we can also hold stakeholders to account to the commitments that they've made.
I love to see some progress, even if it's small, and also to see places where improvements have been made. So you know that there is a path forward that can work, or at least is going in the right direction. And also to see some of the critiques or opportunities for improvement, if I can rephrase that. It's a trend throughout the report, I'd say, that there are some improvements, but also there's a lot of critiques. There's a lot of critical findings of the international aid system and many recommendations for UN agencies and INGOs. And I'm wondering, Brianna, if I can put that to you. We're both at IRC and INGO. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I really want to make it, you know, very clear that the IRC is 100% implicated by the recommendations that we've made in the report. And we explicitly mention ourselves in the recommendations. And there's icons next to the recommendations indicating which ones are for INGOs, which is not just others, but also ourselves as an INGO. I mean, the IRC is absolutely part of the system that needs to change and needs to become a more feminist system. And that's in terms of improving funding to WROs and WLOs. That's including improving how we seed leadership space for WROs and WLOs, and also how we hold ourselves accountable to commitments that we've made as the IRC. So just to, you know, to give an example of two commitments that the IRC has made, we have recently signed up for the Pledge for Change, which was a Global South-led initiative that has three pillars around one, equitable partnerships, two, authentic storytelling, and three, influencing for change. I hope that the report is something, for example, that feeds into the idea of Pledge for Change, that we need to be more equitable and have more equitable partnerships, that we need to be authentic in the way that we're talking about these issues and not fall into colonial or racist narratives that you see in the past in humanitarianism, and that we influence for change ourselves. And then also, you know, just to note that the IRC has commitments around partnerships. So with our partnership model, which is relatively, and it's a new partnership model, all country teams are encouraged to ask the question, why not partner? And the IRC is also committed that that half of all new partnerships should be with WROs and WLOs. So that's where also that intersectional and gendered element comes into play. And just to say, we make a lot of other recommendations, and I would encourage listeners to check those out, because it's just, there's so much in the report. But we also make recommendations to the UN, including OCHA, and we make recommendations to the GBV Area of Responsibility, which is the coordinating body for GBV and humanitarian settings. And all of these recommendations are framed around those three core areas of looking at funding, looking at leadership, and looking at accountability. Karina touched on some of those already in thinking about improving funding to WROs and WLOs.
I think it's really helpful how those have been framed in the report along those three areas. It makes it really easy if you want to, let's say, dig further into decision making. There are some really actionable pieces in there. There are some that are kind of obvious when I see it on there, and I'm like, of course we should be doing this, but it's really nice to see it there. And there are some that are going to require some dedicated work and some critical views of our own organizations and other organizations that we work with or other fund managing agencies. There's a lot of room in there for action. I want to go back a bit to the funding piece. I know that this isn't the first time that development initiatives that you've looked at funding to women's rights and women-led organizations. How do the findings from this report fit within your wider research agenda?
I would just very briefly go back to the report series that Brianna mentioned. So development initiatives started kind of collaborating and working with IRC around the time of the Why Not Local and understanding the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on humanitarian response and also on women and girls and also women's organizations. And last year, we put out a report looking into some of these commitments, some of the commitments that Brianna mentioned as being IRC commitments, but kind of more broadly, kind of wider commitments of the international humanitarian community around. So I mentioned the grand bargain. There's also commitments specifically on kind of GBV, including the Oslo conference and the call to action on protection from gender-based violence in emergencies, and all of these financial commitments, increasing also recognition at policy level as well, and policy commitments need kind of better kind of data and more scrutiny of where the money is going to also, I guess, drive transparency, improve kind of reporting of data and of progress made against this commitment. So last year, our report, our Global Humanitarian Assistance specific report on tracking funding for what we call gender relevant humanitarian response. So this is looking at a kind of GBV funding within humanitarian response plans, but also kind of wider gender specific funding, and also trying to understand a bit levels of gender mainstreaming also in humanitarian programming. So this is how we started looking at the tracking picture. And what the report last year tried to do was just to try and understand how we can come up with a methodology to analyze at the global level the funding flowing to GBV, gender-specific humanitarian programming, and also to local and national responders, most of them women's organizations. So really kind of starting this process and drafting a methodology, this collaboration with IRC on this report on Why Wait, and especially the chapter 3 that we discussed on Where is the Money, is really a really good continuation of this work and trying to dig a bit deeper into the pooled funds as a funding mechanism to better fund women's rights and women's led organizations. So this is where the board sits and the work at DEI sits. I would also very quickly also mention the work of the GHA report, the Global Humanitarian Assistance report that we publish every year. We'll be publishing this in the summer at ECOSOC, because I think it's important to contextualize and understand how the funding to women's rights and women-led organizations sits within the wider funding picture for the humanitarian system overall. And this is what the GHA report does. It really kind of sits within the wider, I guess, commitments and system reform that is currently driven through, I guess, the grand bargain and such other commitments.
I'm wondering, just speaking to these trends and what might be possible in the funding spaces, if you think, you know, between these three pillars of funding, leadership and decision-making, and accountability and equitable partnerships, if you think one of these areas is going to drive change across the others, or if you think these are all required at the same time to make any kind of advancements?
I think it is incredibly difficult to tease out some of those interlinkages, and something that we felt while, you know, looking at the analysis of this report and in the drafting of this report is that funding and leadership are linked. So, you know, we have WROs and WLOs are underfunded, but also part of the equation is that they're not allowed to be kind of taking up leadership spaces in humanitarian settings, and the power is very much being held by international actors. So yes, it's an issue of funding, but also it's a question of leadership, because in our theory of change, we would believe that when WROs have more representation and are able to take up strategic decision-making roles in humanitarian coordination, then that, of course, also will have an impact on how funding decisions are made. So in the report, we talk a lot about the country-based pooled fund advisory boards, and the advisory boards are the boards that make decisions around the funds. And unfortunately, perhaps not surprisingly, there's very, very few WROs and WLOs that are represented on those country-based pooled fund advisory boards. So that is a commitment that OCHA has already made to change. I think it's that now they've committed to have one WRO or WLO on every advisory board in countries where there's a country-based pooled fund. The short answer to your question, Christy, is in my view, they are all interlinked. Certainly funding and leadership. And then, you know, thinking about accountability, I think that's around keeping the pedal down on the actors who have made commitments to keep going and keep having momentum to change. Because as, you know, I think everyone on this call knows, change doesn't happen automatically.
And I think another example of that, and just to complement what Brianna was saying, is really how funding and representation and leadership is linked around. For example, we look at the quantity of funding, so really kind of counting the US dollars that get dispersed under a pool fund, but we also look quite carefully at the quality of the funding. So this would be things like funding that is passed on with the same level of flexibility or duration. So if it's multi-year funding, if it's also funding that contributes to the core mission of the organization, thinking about overheads. And I think all of these things are really linked when you think about leadership and accountability as well. And maybe Daria, you can speak a bit more to this from your organization's experience.
The problems that we are discussing today are very multidimensional and interlinked. So the solutions are. So I would really say that everything is needed, and probably you are right in telling that it's not only, you know, the amount of direct funding that is the most important thing to consider. It's also the organizations that it is directed to. It's also the projects that are being, you know, prioritized among everything else, because in particular, gender-based violence prevention and response projects are being pushed aside, because in general, the women agenda and their interests are not considered as important in the country that is going through the humanitarian emergency response. So I would really stress out that all of these components are needed, and also the authentic storytelling as well, because I get a feeling that it is quite often overlooked, but it shouldn't, because visibility and communication of the efforts on the ground and the local professionals is sometimes key to achieving the impact.
I was just nodding over here, Daria, while you were speaking, and it reminded me that there's an an interesting part of the report in the qualitative findings, where we hear from an organization that says that oftentimes WROs and WLOs are coordinating themselves, and unfortunately, international actors don't show up to that. Instead, international actors are waiting for the WROs and WLOs to come to them. But also, I don't want to put you on the spot, Daria, but when Karina was talking about how, you know, talking about the power of data, we see in the report that the funding picture for this, the country-based pooled funds to GBV in Ukraine, was not a good picture, where, you know, the only project was going to a UN agency. And actually that this was different than what we were seeing in other sectors, where more money was being channeled to national and subnational actors. And I suppose I wanted to ask you, I think data is power, because sometimes I'm sure organizations might feel that they're underfunded, but sometimes unless we have the data in front of us, then people don't believe you, unfortunately. And so I just wanted to see if you had any follow-up to our, you know, kind of conversation earlier when we were talking about funding in Ukraine at the moment and what that has been like for your organization.
Yes, actually, I wasn't surprised when I saw this particular result of the research, because especially the projects that concerned women's rights, gender-based violence, sexual abuse, conflicts related to sexual violence, and other things related to these, as well as children's rights, they are often not given to the local actors, as I perceive it, out of the prejudice that we do not have the capacity to implement them according to the international best practice, that we do not possess, you know, the knowledge and competencies, that we do not follow the procedures and do not have really transparent and inclusive instruments, feedback mechanisms and everything. And that is simply not true, because I know, and that's not only from the experience of the NGO girls, but I know so many resourceful women-led non-governmental organizations, non-profit organizations in Ukraine who can and are ready to implement large-scale projects aimed at helping women, but they are just glossed over and, you know, taught again and again with absolutely the same prevention of sexual exploitation and abuse content that we are familiar for years, actually, and with the same trainings all over and over again, because it seems like the international community just can't believe that Ukrainian women already have possessed that capacity. They cannot imagine that this can be. It sounds a little bit weird, and I don't actually want to be true here, but it seems like that from a very personal perspective.
Wondering if I can put one of you on the spot, and what do you think, whether consciously or subconsciously, happens in that space? Do you think that, let's say a UN agency has funding and they want to partner with someone, do you think they go with like an IRC type or another INGO because they have a relationship already, they've worked with them before? Do you think it's because there's a shared kind of language about how we talk about GBV and emergencies or just humanitarian programming? What do you think it is that fuels what you're talking about, Daria?
Yes, it's definitely that. And I wouldn't assume that there are any, you know, conflicts of interests or any particular relationships between, let's say, a particular UN agency and a particular NGO. It's much more convenient for them to stick together because they have this shared experience. They have shared instruments and strategies. They share a language. Most usually it's the English language, which not all of the Ukrainians can speak professionally. So it's just a matter of being used to. It's just a habit and a convenience to go to someone who you're absolutely confident in and you're comfortable to work. And it's understandable from the one side, but it's really harmful in terms of saving processes and emergency response that is going on, to overlook local organizations, because it's much easier and more convenient to work with someone where you don't get to check all the policies in place and to check all of the minor things and to hire an interpreter and some additional personnel to drive the projects. I understand that, but I also understand how much harm it may do.
I would just like to add to this that this is definitely not just the case for Ukraine. And I can just mention DI development initiatives worked last year and this year with the Turkish Refugee Council working on the Syrian refugee response, and very similarly finding the same kind of levels of underfunding to local and national actors in Turkey. And I think one of the main findings was around looking at how donor funding instruments and regulations, but also funding preferences, are set up to be an advantage of international funded programs or international organizations at the expense of local national organizations that are still unable to access much of the international donor funding directly. So the way the system is set up and the funding instruments also contribute to this, from what we found.
I just want to thank Daria for speaking truth to power. And I want to share a quote from the report that will say this better than I can, and is from the lived reality of an organization that said, quote, "Donors prefer to fund INGOs because they have a history with them. New partners are a headache for them." So I think that's a disappointing response to your question, Christy, that there can be this preference and this bias. And for many of the reasons that Daria mentioned, that on the surface can seem harmless, but actually they result in the exclusion of national and subnational organizations. And we do dive into this in the report a bit more. And we talk about how for the country-based pooled funds, for example, there's a number of policies that have to be in place, as Daria kind of mentioned, that are specific to partnering with the UN in particular. And so there are a number of factors. And so kind of some of the rhetoric that I spoke with my team while we were working on this report was that the system does not meet WROs and WLOs where they are. Instead, WROs and WLOs are expected to meet the international system where it is and with what it wants and its requirements.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that comes out clearly in this space. We've got this puzzle 90% built. What are you going to contribute to this existing thing rather than, you know, what's a better way for this to work overall? I have just a couple more questions. I want to ask, I think it's maybe the pessimistic side of me just wants to get this out, but let's say there's somebody who reads this report and they're not sold on these things. I'm curious what you think their primary critique of this would be and how you would respond to that.
I think that for donors, for the UN, for INGOs, they're very concerned about risk. They often view WROs and WLOs, or, you know, more widely national and subnational organizations, as risky. And in my view, unfortunately, I think there hasn't always been a kind of a creativity to solving some of these risk mitigation issues. And so instead, it's kind of written off. And I think, I'm not sure if Karina, you might have, you're welcome to jump in there as well. But I would say that where we come back is we say that WROs and WLOs are absolutely essential to humanitarian response and essential to GBV prevention and response. And as Daria mentioned, the organizations on the ground, quote unquote, I don't always love that expression, but have been there for longer and they know their communities intimately. They speak the language and they often know the response that's needed. And so it is absolutely bonkers that we are still talking about this. And another thing that we talked about in this report is that localization is just moving too slowly. And we say this in the report that it's too unambitious and that we're not changing fast enough.
Yeah, and I think ultimately localization is so much more than just funding. It's about kind of interrogating and breaking this power, breaking down this kind of broader power relations between the donors and the international organizations, and then the intermediary organizations, the UN and the local actors. And I think this, of course, there's going to be resistance from the ones that hold the power and hold the funding at the moment to actually give that away or make that a bit more leveled. What I really take from this report and from the localization research more broadly is this kind of framework to recognize the experience and the leadership of the local organizations, and really moving us away from thinking about funding as a transactional relationship, as a kind of UN agency to INGO, to international NGO, to local actor kind of relationship, and really thinking about lived experiences and leadership and what you were talking about, Daria.
Yes, if I may go in here, I would totally support and female localization is about strengthening and capacity building, but it is two-sided. It should not only be directed to the national organizations, women-led organizations, or any else. It should be mutual, because we also have so many resources we are willing to recommend and we are willing to share. And it's not only some local, contacts with local authorities or any opinion leaders on the ground. It's also so many inputs from a previous projects and so many recommendations that we have worked on for many years before the emergency started, and so many NGOs got attracted to Ukraine to work here. So my ideal solution to speed the localization up a little bit would be to understand and really accept the fact that localization efforts and these capacity building efforts should be two-sided and very context sensitive.
I think this is leading to our last more hopeful question. I think, Karina, the way you spoke about this as being not just a transactional relationship, yes, that I think that's largely a very apt description for what happens in these funding and recipient relationships. I think paired with that, we see that for GBV programs globally, when women rights organizations or women-led organizations, or really just women from the community, are involved in the process of providing services, we see quicker reporting times. We see more diverse types of violence reported by more diverse types of perpetrators. We see reports go up, which also indicates a level of trust and also a level of safety. And I think speaks to the sustainability of really localizing this work. So I want to ask my last question. I'll start with you, Daria, and then others can add in. We're looking at this in the future. What kind of aid system would you like to see for women-led and women's rights organizations? We've talked a lot about the benefits here and some things that could change, but what would you like to see in the future?
That's actually a very complex question. And I'm afraid that if I really start with everything I have in mind, we won't be able to close the podcast anytime soon. But if I am to name just one or two things I consider most important, it would be, first of all, what I have and others have already mentioned, very clear and conscious and context-sensitive capacity building, driven by demand, not just to tick some boxes, but to answer the needs that really exist on the ground and to highlight the strengths, not only the weaknesses, of the women-led and women rights organizations. Not to teach repetitively something that audiences are already well aware of, because actually the international standards and instruments that the system is willing to share are very valuable by their own. It's just that they need the right audience to be the most effective. And probably the second thing I would really want to see would be more flexibility to the projects and to the system of role, for the projects to consider their exit strategies, their sustainable impact. Because what we see now is that funding is very time bound, and all of the projects are expected to give enormous results in very short times, especially in terms of supporting women and children, for example, because it seems that they just need some small bits of help and then they will be back on track and everything will be good. But it's not like that, because the emergency hit where there were already some weaknesses even before the war. And this flexibility would require better needs assessment, with more respondents, with more visibility to marginalized and silenced groups, which we do not see now. Even if we include women and children to the target beneficiaries, we always, or almost always, overlook LGBT plus community members. We overlook minorities, especially Romas and some other marginalized groups. And we very often push aside people with disabilities because they are not convenient to work with, because they have very specific needs. And this system just really, really angers me. So I would say this is a very important thing I would like to see more.
I love that. I think from your words, I think to the powers that be, I think this report overall really highlights the need for a feminist approach to aid reform. And this means that international actors would go beyond radical adherence to reciprocity and capacity sharing to implement co-leadership, co-visibility, and co-decision-making through partnership frameworks and funding models. The recommendations in the report are really designed for policymakers to understand how we can take tangible steps to get where we need to be, to get where Daria was saying. And it must be said that good practices do exist. The report challenges listeners and donors to ask why wait to implement them. There are models out there. The report, which I would encourage everyone to view, we've only got a small snippet of what's included in there, is available on rescue.org as well as gbbresponders.org. Please check it out. If you don't have a lot of time, there's even a summary report. They've done all the work for you. And don't hesitate to get in touch if you have questions or comments. Last but certainly not least, sending a special thanks to all of those who were involved in the report, from IRC colleagues and humanitarian stakeholders through to all the women-led and women rights organizations who gave their time and expertise to this project. We truly hope to see real change. And thank you to Brianna, Karina, and Daria today for sharing your voice and speaking truth to power.
Safety, voice, respect. Join the WPE movement.